CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Ukraine crisis, Taiwan crisis. I welcome Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, Dickinson College, the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. We go immediately to Ukraine with news, two pieces that are discordant, however, at the same time, point to larger stories. For one, PBS reporting, Ukraine says nine Russian warplanes destroyed in massive Crimea air base blasts. Ukraine's Air Force said Wednesday that nine Russian warplanes were destroyed in massive explosions at an air base in Crimea amid speculation they were the result of a Ukrainian attack. That is odd, and we wait for more clarification. But then we have this. This from the Pentagon. Pentagon confirms transfer of anti-radar missiles to Ukraine. In a commentary to CNN, a Pentagon spokesman said the type of missile sent was the AGM-88 high-velocity anti-radar missile, HARM. What I know from reading history books is the HARM is the missile you use in the initial airstrike. You take out, you blind the enemy, and then your warplanes come in. Jeff, a very good evening to you. Let's begin with the report from Crimea. This is fog of war, we're guessing, but the long-awaited counteroffensive may be coming, maybe not, maybe a ruse, but hitting in Crimea, if that is what's happened, or events in Crimea, if it's sabotage or accident, that's fundamental to the Russian drive to assume that Crimea is secure. Apparently it is not. Good evening to you, Jeff.
Good evening to you, John. You're exactly right. The attack on this particular airbase, the so-called Saki airbase, was extraordinary. You know, it's 200 kilometers from the closest Ukrainian position, which puts it far beyond the range of the HIMARS multiple rocket system that we provided, because we never provided them the long-range rockets for that particular system. Now, the HARM missile, you suggest, might have been involved if it was used as part of an airstrike by the Ukrainians, because they would use it to, as you suggest, blind the radars and then set the stage for the other aircraft to come in and actually hit the base. But again, the Ukrainians have yet to claim full responsibility for the attack or even suggest how they might have done it. There is speculation it could have been done by aircraft. There is speculation that they could have done some of the anti-ship missiles that we have provided and others that have ranges of 200 to 300 kilometers, which could have hit those targets. Or there has been some speculation that it could have been a combined special operation partisan attack by the Ukrainians against this particular base, because we know partisan activities have been growing increasingly in Crimea. But not only does this have operational and tactical military significance, as you suggest, John, it has enormous, I think, strategic political significance. The Russians have been very adamant that they have occupied this area of Crimea since 2014, but this is part of Russia. This is not negotiable, and in fact have suggested if there ever are negotiations between Ukraine and Russia to bring this war to a close, that acceptance of Crimea and this territory is in fact something that has to be given by the Ukrainians at the onset. Zelensky has never accepted that, and he has said, suggested that, well, if we did conduct an attack like this in Crimea, we're going to do it again.
It's strange, Jeff, right at this point in the war, with the battle space apparently frozen or near to frozen, let's say shivering, we do not see large movement either way. There's talk of counteroffensive. There's talk of the Russians gathering their forces here or there. There's questions about how much is flowing through to the Ukrainian front. There are doubts all across the world about the Russian ability to resupply and even to gather together a sufficient force for offense. And then all of a sudden, what looks like sabotage. Isn't that strange, Jeff? It's out of nowhere, a dirty war.
Yeah, it is a little strange, John, though partisan activities and coordinating those type of activities take some time. So though it would be a few months before that got organized, perhaps is not surprising. What continues to surprise me is this further illustrates something that I think no one expected at the onset, and that is the Russians would never, ever be able to establish air superiority or even air supremacy over the battlefield. And that has allowed the Ukrainians to mass forces for a counteroffensive, as we see now unfolding in the south in the direction of Kherson. I always think back to the Gulf War where I was involved, and our establishment of air superiority and actually air supremacy at the onset meant that Iraqi units were frozen in position. Even if we'd given them our battle plan of where we were coming, they couldn't have repositioned forces, because as soon as they started moving, they would have been destroyed. And that doesn't have, that has not happened in Ukraine. And furthermore, with the arrival of the HARM and other systems like that, pushes the Russians either farther back in terms of where they can position air defense, and then allows more mobility for Ukrainian ground forces so they can mass for those counteroffensives. And furthermore, of course, as they're able to conduct a ground offensive, as they seem to be doing, counteroffensive in the south, forces the Russians to then pull forces out of the southeast, the Donbas region, to try to reinforce, and puts more pressure on already overstretched Russian supply lines, which the Ukrainians have also been striking with some effectiveness using longer range systems like the HIMARS.
Now for a really science fiction story. Foreign ministers from the G7 group of nations say Russia must immediately hand back control of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant to Ukraine. This is staggeringly strange. Russia has occupied the largest nuclear power plant in Europe for weeks. They've established a fortress there. I'm told that they've stored weapons there. There's a unit established in the area, defying the Ukrainians to attack because, of course, their container vessels, their fuel rods stored. At the same time, we get misinformation or disinformation that if the Russians are driven from Zaporizhzhia, they'll destroy it. Jeff, what to make of this? I know it's a war crime, but we're not doing legal talk here. What to make of this as an element of the war? Does this make sense that Russia would occupy a nuclear power plant?
It doesn't make sense in many ways tactically, but maybe it makes sense politically. They know they did occupy Chernobyl early on in the conflict, and they actually had troops digging in Chernobyl, which is beyond bizarre belief. Now, they did subsequently pull out of that area, of course, which is in the northern part of Ukraine. You're right, John. They've occupied Zaporizhzhia since March. They put in artillery units. We estimate about 500 Russian troops are there, and they see it as being invulnerable. They can fire artillery from there. Ukrainians somewhat hesitant to fire back. They have kept Ukrainian workers on the site to maintain the plant. Some of them have been escaped. Some of them have been reported to have been tortured. So this is a really very threatening situation that the IAEA, as well as the Group of Seven foreign ministers, have said is moving towards a catastrophe. And this would not be a localized Ukrainian catastrophe, but would be a regional catastrophe. Don't forget, for the Russians, they keep claiming this particular territory really should be part of Mother Russia. It doesn't seem to make any sense that you would want to capture this terrain and try to secure the population that you think are abused, but suddenly create a massive nuclear catastrophe in the middle of the area that you're trying to capture.
We have this Reuters report. Anti-aircraft defenses around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant will be strengthened following days of reported shelling on the site. This from Russian-installed separatist officials speaking to RIA Novosti, which is a news agency in Moscow. A man by the name of Belitsky, head of the Russian-backed administration in Zaporizhzhia, said the nuclear station was working normally and damaged power lines have been restored. Jeff, you're a professional officer, retired. Were you ever given instructions or guidance in the event that you ran up against a nuclear power plant in the field, or were dealing with a nuclear power plant that was in the way of the combat?
Not really, except on exercises. We created maps and would mark out those areas that were occupied by sensitive items. Nuclear power plants could be one, chemical power plants could be another, not to maneuver in those areas. But I remember questioning GDP plants in the defense attacks of Central Europe, wanting to make sure we'd identify where those particular facilities were at for the same reasons that we're seeing right here in the case of Zaporizhzhia. And this is a question of modern warfare. Such facilities, whether they are chemical, whether they are nuclear, are very common in advanced industrial societies. And the possibility of them being damaged and therefore creating massive collateral damage, which seems an odd phrase to use, is certainly not out of the range of the possible and certainly has to be considered in military operations. The Russians are very likely, I think, John, to ignore these pleas by the G7 foreign ministers. There's supposed to be a UN Security Council meeting on this tomorrow, but to me, it's unclear whether the Russians will use that as an opportunity to actually negotiate some safe transition or just to score cheap propaganda points.
We come to the Biden administration within these last hours said it was shipping its biggest yet direct delivery of weapons to Ukraine as that country prepares for a potentially decisive counteroffensive in the south. This is the Army Times reporting. Sending $1 billion in rockets, ammunition, and other materials. I look at a photograph of Air Force Staff Sergeant Cody Brown of the 436th Aerial Port Squadron looking at what is called a pallet of 155 millimeter shells. Jeff, those are big shells. That's big. That's heavy stuff shipping that in. And I'm looking at what, about a dozen of tens of thousands of these shells? Is that how many have been sent?
You have to understand, John, the expenditure rate for the Ukrainians, as best we could tell, was about 6,000 artillery rounds a day at times. The Russians may have been firing as many as 60,000. Now, that has come down significantly over the last couple of weeks. Perhaps that bespeaks problems with their supply system. But artillery comes in one variety, big, heavy, and ugly, as I used to say. And I commanded for many years 155 military artillery units. But the acquisition of more ammunition like this, the acquisition of the HIMAR, the acquisition of the HARMS, I think helps the Ukrainians now shape the war for the counteroffensive. And now we're seeing those HIMARS more and more integrated into units where they're actually having an effect on the battlefield. The Ukrainians say the firing of the HIMARS, when you hear it in the distance, is the most lovely music that you hear in Ukraine these days. And that's been augmented by other multiple rockets launcher systems provided by other European countries. For example, the Germans have also provided the Mars II multiple rocket system. But up to now, John, the United States has provided about $9 billion in direct military assistance to the Ukrainians. And secondly, what we're seeing, I think, is the supply system now hitting its stride, where those deliveries are happening more quickly because they're coming directly from U.S. military stocks, whereas in past, we have been trying to divert older stocks and perhaps some stocks that were actually Russian or Soviet made from other European countries and then backfilling them. So the system is becoming more efficient, and it's going directly from the United States, which means we're able to speed the ammunition and supplies to Ukraine more quickly.
I've read that what the HIMARS can do is very accurately destroy bridges and transit points that slow or make impossible the Russian advance. Is that how they're being used?
It seems to be so, John, exactly. And we're providing them the precision-guided munitions associated with those particular rocket launchers. And for the Ukrainians right now, the combination of that and such things as counter-battery radar systems, which give them an accurate location of Russian artillery, then can allow those HIMARS to be very effective in destroying Russian artillery. They also know that the Russians are heavily dependent on artillery and railway systems to move that ammunition and supplies. Well, it's pretty easy to get out a map and get a very accurate location of railway networks because they don't move. And as soon as you get the accurate location with a weapon with the accuracy of HIMARS, you can have devastating effect on those particular systems. And that slows, obviously, the resupply of manpower, material, and ammunition to the Russians, helping you either hold off their offensive or begin your counteroffensive.
Is the DOD learning from this, Jeff? Is this the HIMARS in the field? Is this a sudden new shiny thing that is emphasized for success?
No, we've been using it for quite a while, John. We used it against ISIS in northern Iraq in the latter part of that war. It's been used in Syria and elsewhere. I think the real thing we're hopefully learning is the expenditure rate for the HIMARS as a multiple rocket system. And now I think the production rate for HIMARS rockets is only about 9,000 a year. Well, we're seeing the Ukrainians go through large numbers of these very, very quickly. So if there's a lesson to be learned, I think it's going to be that we need to expand our wartime stocks of rockets we have on hand in case we get into a major contingency.
I'm speaking with Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News, Dickinson College, the CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. We go from the European front to the Pacific front and the threats to Taiwan. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.